And welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jane McCafferty, guest host of Prosody. My guest today is the writer William Wall. William Wall is the author of four novels, three collections of poetry, and two previous volumes of short fiction. His work has won many prizes, including the Virginia Faulkner Award, the Patrick Kavanaugh Award, the Sean O'Fallon Prize, and many more. He has been short or longlisted for many other prizes, including the Man Booker Prize, the National Book Award, the Raymond Carver Prize, and the Manchester Fiction Prize. His work has been translated into many languages, and he translates himself from Italian. So welcome. Welcome, William.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you like to start off with giving us a reading of part of your book?
Sure. A long time ago, I had two sisters, and we lived on an island. There was me and Jeannie and Em. They called me Grace, but I never had much of that. I was an awkward child. I still am all these years later. Our house had two doors, one to the south, one to the north. Its garden looked towards the setting sun. It was a garden of apple trees and fuchsia, and everything in it leaned away from the wind. Dry stone walls encircled it, and sheep and children broke them down. My mother lived there with us. Boats came and went bringing food and sometimes sheep, and there were times when we lived by catching fish and rabbits, though we were not so good at either. Richard Wood came in the Iliad, his wooden yawl, always, it seemed, when a gale of wind threatened. He dropped his anchor in the Sound and stayed for nights at a time. Mother said he liked his home comforts. He was younger than her, though not by much, and she was younger than father. Father liked to come first, she said. In the summertime, we swam naked in the crystal water and saw his anchor bedded in the sand, the marks the chain left where it swung to tide or wind. Many a time I swam down that chain, hauling myself deeper, hand over hand, until I could stand on the bottom. But he took no notice. In calm weather, we could see my footprints on the seabed as if I lived down there and had stood a long time in one place looking up. Or perhaps that was not how it happened. Words have that way of invading memory. The stories they tell us become our stories. What I remember and what I forget may be one and the same thing, or they may merely depend upon each other. And what my father remembered for me. There were three islands, and they were youth, childhood, and age, and I searched for my father in every one.
Thank you. It's a beautiful opening to this book, and it made me think about you as a poet, because all through the book, I was just underlining things that were where the language was so crystalline and charged and compressed, and I turned the book over and I thought, oh, okay, he's also I read your bio and you'd written many books of poetry, so I wondered if you might talk about the relationship between yourself as a poet and yourself as a fiction writer and how the two inform each other.
I used to think that I began as a poet, and I suppose I did begin as a poet, really. Though I found recently when I was asked to write an article about about the beginning of my writing, I found that actually I was writing short stories even at that early time in my early teens. But I think I spent probably most of my life thinking of myself as a poet and writing poetry. I think the relationship between my poetry and my prose is the same as my relationship with text messages and emails. I'm obsessive about language, and I'm obsessive about avoiding cliché. I don't know if I succeed all the time at that, but it's a major obsession of mine. I think the thing that poetry teaches you is attentiveness to words and to how words spark against each other, how they relate to each other, and, you know, what effect they may have. So the kind of poetry I write is very pared down, very short, short lines. And my novels are also short. And I usually begin with a much longer novel and gradually whittle it down to something quite short. In fact, it's a struggle for me not to reduce everything to the length of a short story.
Well, it's really working in this book to create all kinds of things. I mean, really interesting insights, or the articulation of the characters' insights are so striking. But also, of course, the landscape is so vivid. I mean, the ocean and the rocks and the rain and the bristles and the bracken and, or thistles, I guess, in the bracken, are so alive. And Flanagan the cat, and, you know, the rocks, the geology, you know, is so present. And I wondered if you could talk about, was that a deliberate choice to make that landscape and the sort of living things in the landscape and the rocks seem as alive as the characters, or nearly so? Was that deliberate, or did that emerge out of some love you have of that landscape, or both?
Both, really. The book begins in Ireland, and it takes place on three islands. One island is off the south coast of Ireland, and I know it very well. It's an uninhabited island. It became uninhabited sometime shortly after our great famine in the 1840s, and the remains of houses are still there. And in one of those houses, it's where I imagine the story beginning. And you can stand on that island and look along the cliffs of the mainland and without really, and even just to see the islands in the bay and wonder how they were formed. There are legends, for example, the particular island where it's set was originally part of a continuous piece of land, which, according to the ancient historical annals, was cracked open by a bad storm sometime in the 10th century or thereabouts. I don't know if that's true. It's probably a myth. But you're conscious all the time because the island is facing the Atlantic, and the Atlantic Ocean, and these terrible storms come up like we have today in Ireland. As I speak, we're undergoing the battery of Hurricane Ophelia. Mm. You can't really stand on an island like that and see the sea coming in without wondering exactly what sort of mechanical effect the sea has on the rocks and how the rocks resist it, and how everything is gradually eroding and disappearing. Mm-hmm. Eventually, sometime in a billion years' time, Ireland will vanish, probably pounded to dust by the Atlantic. That geology is very strong. And the second island is the Isle of Wight in the south of England, and it's a polar opposite almost in a way, in that it's a chalk island and it's literally falling into the sea. You know, people's houses fall into the sea on a fairly regular basis there. And so you've got this chalk landscape. And then the third island is a volcanic island in the Bay of Naples. So where, you know, in each of the settings that I chose for the stories, the geology forces itself upon your consciousness very, very strongly.
Did you go and spend time in those other two islands too? Oh,
I did. Well, the second island, the Isle of Wight in England, my aunt lived there. She was like a second mother to me. And I spent a lot of the summers of my childhood there and on that island. And indeed, when she was very ill later, I spent a lot of time there as well. And as regards the island of the Bay of Naples, yes, I've spent quite a bit of time there as well. It's a little island. There are three islands in the Bay of Naples: Capri, Ischia, which are the two big tourist islands. Capri, was a favorite of one of the emperors. I forget which one of the Roman emperors. So they've had a lot of tourism for a long time. And then there's this little island called Procida. And if any of your listeners have ever seen the film Il Postino or The Postman,
yeah,
that's mainly set on that island.
Okay.
And it's still very much like that. It still looks very much like that.
It doesn't surprise me that you spent childhood, a lot of childhood summers on an island, because it just seemed that the source of the landscape in these stories was really deep, that it wasn't something that was just, you know, claimed as an adult, but that went way back.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm really attracted to islands. I love the idea of being on a small confined space, if only for a short period of time.
Would you like to read another passage?
Sure. So this story is set in that second island, the Isle of Wight, in the south coast of England. And it concerns one of the two sisters that the book is about. It's Jeannie. And Jeannie is a geologist. At this stage, she's a teenager, and she's walking on a place called Undercliff Beach on the island with her mother's lover, Richard Wood, and as we will see what happens. We are fossil hunting at Undercliff Beach. It's a September afternoon after school. The sea is a mirror that stretches as far as the horizon. We've walked miles. He was always one for endurance. He wears shorts, a pale yellow shirt, and a pair of battered rubber sneakers. We have a bottle of Robinson's lemon barley water and a wax paper packet of ham sandwiches. We sit down to examine or only find a tiny ammonite from the London clay, solitary in my canvas bag. Still, it is beautiful, coppery, fractured, abstract. You know, he says, what I love is the imperfections. Perfection is a dangerous myth. What we need to love is our imminence, not our possibilities. I know what he means, although I don't know what imminence is. It doesn't seem necessary to the thought. Saying imminence means he's treating me as an equal. I like that. He ignores me. He closes his eyes for a time. When he opens them, he indicates the cliffs at our back. Tell me about this place, he says. So I tell him the story of the chalk and mud that is the island. I know the story well. He lies back, closes his eyes and listens. Even that lying back is accomplished like a deliberate gesture, an unfolding of the body in equilibrium. I have always known this grace. It's part of the landscape of my childhood, as natural as a tree moving in the wind. His body straightens as smoothly as one might open a fist and straighten a hand. His lean face and clear eyes, then the long pale lashes. Now I can look at his face, now that he can't see me. I try to memorize it, the downy hair around his lips almost like a girl's. In the steely light I see it, and a tiny scar near his left eye, so smooth I feel I could rub it away with my finger. It's a dream, the flat sea, the hot sand, the canvas bag of tools, and the single burnished ammonite. The story of the rock, the clay, the sand, told in millions of years. Sweat on my face, in my armpits, between my breasts and my legs. The humidity is rising. Over on the French side of the channel, I can see cumulus building into giant anvils. As I talk, I learn something new, and it is this, that two people could commit any enormity, and it wouldn't alter the long history of stone by as much as a micron. On this day, in the 4.5 billion year existence of the Earth, I could have exactly what I want, what I had always wanted, and afterwards, the universe would be exactly the same, without waste, without imbalance. So when I see that he's asleep, I bend down and put my mouth close to his. I'm careful not to touch. I am so close, I can almost feel my own shadow. He wakes, I draw back. I feel my face redden, I try to look away. Then he puts his arms around me and pulls me down. Later he says that he did it because he didn't want to hurt me. He didn't want me to feel rejected. But it doesn't feel like that. First there is the kiss. Everything is rougher than I expected. By the time he feels for my breast, I am beyond caring, beyond doing, beyond resistance, beyond common sense. I've fallen for sex, fallen into sex. I'm falling in sex. He's almost weightless. When he enters me, it hurts, and my pain belongs to the subterranean world, primitive as the clay. His body is slacker than I expected. A small paunch begins at his waist and settles in a downward parabola to his groin. His pubic hair is red. His penis is a surprise, although I had imagined what they would feel like, read about them, seen them represented on toilet walls and magazines. I didn't see it before he entered me, but afterwards it is small and sticky and amusing. I want to touch it, but I don't dare. I don't know the etiquette. He is 20 or more years older than me. This is sex. He rolls sideways onto the sand. Oh God, he says. I think it sounds like anguish. I don't care. I find I'm holding my breath. I release it slowly. Sex, I tell myself. I've had it. Sex. Somewhere in a disconnected but synchronous life, a point from which I can view myself to advantage and still belong. I am amused. There I am, lying in the sand, full of semen. This is sex. I've had sex. There are fossils everywhere. I'm marveling and silently laughing. I'm inwardly celebrating and at the same time reverent. Sex. I lie there with my legs spread, my shirt pulled down, awkwardly. The old bag of tools is beside my head. I can almost sense the numinous reality of the ammonite. I'm sore, but not as much as I had imagined. I've been learning things from magazines, though they haven't prepared me for the fullness, the experience of being ridden of his final explosive stop. The terror is pleasure. There isn't enough of it. I want it again. I want to be able to experience each part of it distinctly, not as a single astonishing mass. Sex. It just happened. I've had it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jane McCafferty, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the writer William Wall, reading from his book The Islands, which has just won the 2017 Drew Heinz Prize for Literature. So thanks for that last reading, William. I was really interested in the character Grace and certain proclamations that she makes. One that struck me was we hold ourselves together by telling stories about ourselves, because these narrators are doing that throughout the book. And I wondered if you could talk about how you think about that idea, and also how the characters Jeannie and Grace are doing that differently from each other, like how you see their main similarities and differences in how they narrate their lives.
Yeah, it's recently, well, not too recently, some years ago when my wife's mother died, the sisters got together to, you know, after the funeral to talk and remember things. And one of the things that struck both of us really forcibly was how people, A, don't remember the same things, and B, when they do remember the same things, they remember them differently. And that idea, it's a commonplace of fiction, the idea that, you know, memory is fallible and that people's experience changes their memory. But I've always believed as well that in the narrating of memory, we actually create memory. In fact, I think psychologists and brain scientists are now beginning to say exactly that. So maybe I should have patented it years ago. I suppose I came from a storytelling family, and both my father and mother told stories, and those stories were really a way of remembering sort of family history and local history and of passing on information. And I was always pretty suspicious, you know, as a child you're suspicious of what your parents tell you. You think they're making it up just to kind of teach you a moral or something like that. But there is one family story that I was able to prove in complete detail, one which I never actually believed, which was that a cousin of my grandmother's eloped on a ship and went to New Zealand, married on the ship, and had three children, two of whom died, and she died from sorrow from the death of the baby. And I always thought this is far too romantic; it's not possible. But by chance, I discovered a letter in my aunt's effects after her death. And it was a letter from New Zealand, and I followed it up, and I found a person on the web doing a family history of that particular family in New Zealand. And I wrote to him, and lo and behold, he was able to verify every single detail of the story. So if my grandmother is listening now, I'm sorry I never believed you. But yes, I think we tell stories to remember, and I think the stories themselves create memory. Even even if they're true, whether they're true or not makes no difference in actual fact. Mm-hmm. We're creating memory through words.
So does that, in a way, make both Jeannie and Grace unreliable in terms of how they're seeing each other? Both of them judge each other pretty harshly, and I don't know. I was drawn to that the lack of sentimentality that's in their tellings. And then when I finished it, I was thinking, I wonder who Jeannie and Grace are apart from the way they diagnose each other, and what you thought about those two characters.
Well, first of all, I think they are fictional characters. They're not real people, and they don't have any life outside the text. Also, I believe firmly in the old adage, I suppose we could call it, that once you write a book, it belongs to the reader. And I'm very reluctant to explain things or say more mm-hmm. than what I've had on the page, really, mm-hmm. about characters, you know. But I think they are, as you say, both unreliable narrators. The reader is left to make a judgment as to who, if anybody, to believe. And I think, in another sense, they're both right and both telling the truth. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's I will leave that to the reader to figure out which is which. But unreliable narration, unreliable memories and stories are really central to the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, very early on, there's the death of the younger sister and the story fabricated about that, which really changes everybody's lives mm-hmm. and is not fully resolved, I think, even at the end of the book. And indeed, the father himself is writing a memoir,
yeah.
which, according to Grace, is not true either.
The one that she tries to destroy.
The one that
she
claims that she destroyed, exactly. Yeah.
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 Okay, could you read us one more passage?
So this is the Grace, the narrator, Grace talking, and it's the central episode of the first story, and it's the story that changes everything else. It's the event that changes everything else for all the other stories in the book. My sister Emily died. She fell from the watchtower. She was scrambling on the stones of the wall. Jeannie said that Em had taken to following her, that she was always in and out of the tower. Later, the coroner would say that she had injured herself on the way down, that her back was broken too. Richard Wood and my father made the story straight for him. He praised their clear, concise evidence and expressed his sympathy with the family. A childhood accident, he said. He quoted the Bible. They know not what they do. They never asked me. At that time, I had other ideas, though I came to believe their story. I was the one who found her. I should have been taking care of her. But I knew where to look. I brought her ashore. Richard Wood was not there. My mother waited at the pier. I carried Em to her and gave the child into her hands. Then I pushed the boat into deeper water and started the Seagull engine. I went for the doctor and the lifeboat, and I phoned Tyrannearing from the public box above Raleigh Pier. They got to the island before me. My mother wanted to bury the child there, but it was against the law. Laws of interment are ancient instruments. They are designed to prevent contagion, disease, and theft. They only appear to be concerned with dignity, love, hospitality. In reality, a grave is a piece of property like any other. It is a small piece of land into which a child is put. It has a stone with the child's name. Time elapsed is recorded. It is a complete archive. It contains flesh and bone and memory and the parentheses of birth and death. And in the end, like most property, it's owned by someone other than the occupant. It is a mortgage on the past. The coroner pieced together a narrative of her death for us. We experienced it as a piece of fiction, less credible, in fact, because it had no internal order, no structuring principle. We fell apart, the world fell apart, but the coroner's inquiry could not touch us. My memories were useless, and in fact, I was already forgetting. It would take me 30 years to remember my part in it. I could tell how she slept with her nose to my back, how she held my mother's hand when she was talking to her, looking up at her face and just holding her hand like a toy. These things cast no light on the matter, though he listened to them patiently enough. My mother remembered. She gave evidence in a tight, hurt voice like a frightened child reciting last night's homework. Even I could see that she was in danger of falling apart or that she had already fallen apart and been put together the wrong way. She kept looking at my father, and he nodded and smiled at her. This is what she said. Em had been with her in the kitchen. It was tea time. It was my day. Then Em was gone. Where is that notice box of a child? And where is Grace? I'll have to go after her. Then she broke down and cried. The coroner gave her tissues. He seemed to have a box ready just in case. Perhaps coroners always do. In time, she continued. She told them that she knew something terrible had happened. Everyone looked for M. I was the one who saw her. I climbed the watchtower wall because it was the highest thing on the island. From the height of the tower, I saw her drifting in the submarine currents among the white and rounded shale from the last cliff fall. She wore blue dungarees and a pink and white striped shirt and one blue rubber sneaker. Her hands were outstretched. She sometimes slept like that too, face down in her bed. My mother's horror was terrible. I remember very little of it. There was a time when I recalled it all, but I found it useless in dealing with her life or my own. Memory is an overrated capacity. It is most useful to those who need to deny things. I remember she was upstairs in bed, and my sister Jeannie and I were sitting in the kitchen. There were candles on the table because the electricity cable had failed, as it often did. Boats were forever anchoring on it despite the warning signs. My father and Richard Wood were upstairs. We could hear my mother's voice. It came in rapid, stuttering bursts like a sewing machine. I remember that an earwig walked across the table in front of us. Jeannie pinched it up and held it to the light. I saw its jaws working, its tail bending and straightening, its antennae. Then she dropped it into the candle. It fell into the molten wax and settled quickly down. It drowned. In the morning, there was the shadow of the earwig in the cold wax. My mother's horror was also perfectly reasonable. One of the things we forget is that the world itself is madder than anything our heads can make. How should one remember one's child falling into the sea, sustaining injuries against the cliff on the way down? After that, everything is impossible. My mother's horror was all-encompassing, all-consuming. It devoured the night and the day, the sun and the moon, God and the future and everything in between. It paralyzed us. It divided us. Jeannie was crying too. I resented her for doing it. It seemed to me she wanted, as always, to be the center of attention, but nobody paid her any heed. Her tearfulness turned into wailing, and then I wanted to choke her. I slapped her once, but it only made her worse. Shut up, I said. It's bad enough. Then I said, pity it wasn't you. Later, the night before we came out of the island, how long was it between M's death and our crossing? I woke to hear running and urgent voices. I stood on the bed to see out the window, but I could not see the ground. I ran down and saw that the front door was open. Richard had been sleeping on the kitchen floor. His sleeping bag was empty. I closed the door and went back to bed. My mother's room was empty too. It meant that she had run away again.
The writing of William Wall from The Islands, which has just won the 2017 Drew Hines Prize for Literature. Thank you so much for being here. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.